Today on Flashpoints, the Bush administration and HUD send bulldozers to New Orleans, where they plan to demolish thousands of housing units as tens of thousands of people still remain homeless or waiting for federal assistance, over 2 years since Hurricane Katrina. Also, Kristen S. reports from Occupied Palestine, Activist Nation, a new segment that focuses on direct actions taking place across the country, features a story on the expanding threats to women's reproductive rights. JR and the Block Report, and a commentary by Mumia Abu-Jamal. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman with Kristen S., JR, and Joe Tugas. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. In Berkeley, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. In New Orleans this weekend, developers are scheduled to begin demolishing four major public housing complexes, a total of 4,600 low-income housing units, resulting in thousands and thousands of low-income families unable to return home to New Orleans or become homeless. This is all happening while the government is evicting thousands of people out of the FEMA trailer parks. These actions are affecting over 50,000 people, while nearly a million homeowners from Louisiana are still awaiting federal money to rebuild their homes. This is also happening at the same time that there are hundreds of homeless people camped out in tents across from City Hall in New Orleans. The city government has been threatening to go in this weekend and destroy the homeless encampment and erect a fence around the park. Grassroots protests have pushed this back temporarily. Homeless folks have been organizing under the name of Homeless Pride and have had up to 1,000 people sleeping across from City Hall and have been occupying the park for months. They estimate that there are currently between 12 and 16,000 homeless people in New Orleans right now. Joining us to talk about the current situation in New Orleans is Bill Quigley. Bill is a leading lawyer in the fight against the home demolitions. Bill, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Oh, thank you. Glad to be with you.
So I understand you're on your way to a march and protest at this moment. Can you describe the situation right now as thousands of families are going to be unable to return to their homes after these projects are demolished this weekend?
Yes. People have tried the courts, and we still have a little bit of hope that there might be some stopping it in the courts, but that hope is fading. Congresswoman Maxine Waters is doing a lot of great work in Congress trying to get something to happen, but the odds against that happening are pretty strong as well. So the big fight right now is by people to try to enforce human rights themselves. The federal government is going forward, as you said, with a demolition of over 4,000 apartments at a time when we are in a deep crisis of affordable housing here. We had a problem before Katrina, but Katrina demolished over 300,000 homes, and so we have homeless people sleeping under the interstate, and you know that people pass by every day. We've had several hundred that have been sleeping out in front of City Hall. As you said, we had thousands of people being pushed out of FEMA trailers, and the federal government is just insistent on demolishing these homes. We have a local housing authority, but the federal government took that over years ago. So these decisions are all being made in Washington, D.C. by President Bush and his political appointees, Alfonso Jackson and the like. There's real significant corruption, FBI investigation going on and all this, and there's a real sense that the Republicans want to make a push to get these hundreds of millions of dollars of contracts out and started before they lose power, and also that there's really no downside for Republicans to displace African-American renters and homeowners who have overwhelmingly been the backbone of the Democratic Party in Louisiana. So it's quite a fight. We had a face-off with bulldozers last night, and we're able to slow and stop one bulldozer for a little bit of time, but this weekend it's going to be expanding out into other developments. So we got quite a fight on our hands.
That's the voice of Bill Quigley. He's a lawyer leading the fight for public housing in New Orleans. And Bill, talking about these four projects, over 4,000 housing units in total, MIT engineers actually came to survey the projects, and they found that these public housing units were structurally sound and easily renovated. So talk about the justification for the government to demolish these projects.
Well, I think as your listeners know, the federal government for some time now has been trying to turn over all of the public housing properties to private developers. And so this is, you know, what's going on across the country. It's just going on in a more graphic fashion and more concentrated fashion right now in New Orleans. And we have been fighting it here, but people across the country have been fighting it as well. We have, these are some beautiful buildings. They're not the towering projects that people think about. They're three-story brick buildings that are called garden-style apartments that the New York Times architecture critic praised, as did the architecture critic for Bloomberg and others. It just makes no sense on any level except for economic exploitation and trying to keep people out of the city of New Orleans. We've gotten a lot of solidarity from people. There are actions in Minneapolis, in Washington, D.C., in the Bay Area, and we just encourage as many people as possible to, you know, to help us out, because this is a struggle not just for us. If they can get away with it with the victims of Katrina, then they can certainly get away with it in the rest of our cities.
And this weekend there will be a major demonstration in Oakland. That's this Friday. Actually, that's tomorrow at 13th and Broadway near the Oakland City Center BART to protest the 4,600 public housing units slated for demolition this weekend. Finally, Bill Quigley, can you talk about the grassroots resistance movements? You're just about to go to another march. How are people mobilizing? What do these actions look like?
Well, actually, the march is just I'm just joining it right as we speak. It's public housing residents. It is affordable housing people from across the Gulf Coast, and we've been joined this week by a number of young people and organizers from around the country who have come to help out as well. So it's the definition of a coalition. There's nobody in charge. It's different groups with different agendas, but everybody knows that the demolition must be stopped. And I don't know if you can hear it or not, but the protest is just coming down the street at this point. It's about half black, half white. A lot of signs. They've taken over the street here, right here, and they're on their way to the HUD office to try to make clear to everybody even what's going on.
And what are they chanting in the background?
Chanting, stop the demolition now.
What kind of signs can you see? What are people saying?
Housing is a human right. Stop the demolitions. Alfonso Jackson is keeping us out. U.S. Human Rights Network. Big one in the front, the coalition to respect public housing. How Katrina was the problem, HUD is a disaster. So that's what's going on here right now, but there'll be a lot more going on. So we appreciate you covering it, and we would encourage anybody who could to try to support Representative Maxine Waters and do whatever you can do in the area there to fight this scandalous injustice.
Wonderful. That's the voice of Bill Quigley. He has just joined a march in New Orleans to protest the housing units that are slated for demolition by the federal government, by the Bush administration there. That's again tomorrow in Oakland. You can demonstrate in solidarity. Wow, it's real. Can you tell us what's going on right now?
Police officers are moving to the front and the back of the protest, but they're just clearing traffic, so they're not fighting with us at this point.
All right, well, we'll keep a very close eye on that, Bill Quigley. Again, tomorrow in Oakland at the Oakland City Center BART, that's 13th and Broadway at 12 noon. Bill Quigley, thank you so much, and we'll be back with you next week.
Okay, thank you.
In Occupy Palestine, I'm Kristen S. This week, Israeli forces attacked and closed three media offices, a Falk TV, a Najah, and Al-Rawad Press in Nablus. They are now considered, quote, loyal to Hamas and Islamic Jihad. Regardless of the fact that Hamas is the democratically elected government of Palestine, yet was not invited to Annapolis. The Israeli forces confiscated equipment and work files. The stations are shut down. This is the closest that the Israeli military occupation government has worked with the Palestinian Authority. Israeli forces took 17 Palestinians from the West Bank to unknown locations early this morning. Under the sound of the mosque and traffic maneuvering through tiny village streets, we move to a small town where Palestinians are arrested and attacked by Israeli government forces and settlers. His name will remain He, but what we can say is that he is a major leader in the leftist Hezbollah, or People's Party. Why is America supporting Israel against Palestine? Why? Are we also living under American occupation? Although he tells me that he is not afraid to speak his mind, he still will not broadcast his name on the air. Now, not just because of the Israelis against whom he speaks freely, but because he is afraid of the Palestinian Authority. But suffice to say, he is the leader of the leftist Hezbollah party, and I am meeting with him in somewhat clandestine conditions. Today, Palestinian Authority security forces arrested 14 more members of the Hamas party in the West Bank. This is the classic Israeli divide-and-conquer technique, which began when Israel funded the beginning of Hamas to take out Fatah in the 1980s, and then tasked Fatah to provide for the protection of the occupiers by taking out Hamas in 2000, that somehow the two fighting Palestinian parties, Fatah and Hamas, are falling for. Now there is another major issue, the authority. There's a problem within. The authority is a problem these days. If I speak about the authority, they will come after me. They will arrest me. He reiterates that there is nothing wrong with calling for freedom, for speaking against the aggressive and entirely destructive Israeli occupation. But still, he hopes I will not broadcast his name. I'm not afraid. We want our rights, our freedom, and we are against the occupation. We love the people of the world. They are our brothers. But we are against the occupation. We're against the occupation. There's no one in the world who is against their own freedom. We're living under the Israeli occupation. It's been 60 years of occupation, 60 years since the creation of their state, and they haven't stopped with anything ever. They take our land, they take our water, they destroy our people, they take or destroy our houses, they take or destroy our farms, the farmland, they take everything. What kind of life or hope is left in the people after 60 years of occupation? In life, the people lose themselves after 60 years of occupation. The refugees started to think that there would be peace. We were working for peace. After the first Intifada of 1987, we were thinking there would be peace when Abu Omar was still with us. But also everything went wrong. They came up with Oslo. Everything that came out of Oslo was wrong. But we were thinking that this was the time. We were expecting great things. There was never a better time to make our state than during Oslo. But Oslo was insincere in its origins. There were and still are international laws and decisions for the Palestinian people that would stop the Israelis. Our decision was made for us in 1947 when they came and took our land. In 1947 they took everything from us. They made their state on top of us, working through until 1948 during that time that the international law was passed for them. And we have remained underneath this since that time. Our rights are present, are known, but are not implemented. Why did they make a new state on top of us? Because of what? What have we done? We have international rights, but they are just laughing at us. They are acting as if they might follow international law and then began taking the West Bank as well, not just inside 48, not just Israel. They put settlements in Gaza, settlements in the West Bank, settlements in Jerusalem, in Jericho. They put in Maale Adumim, in Salamuna, in Hebron, in our entire country. They left nearly none of our land, nearly nothing of our nation. They really didn't leave anything. During the Oslo talks in the early 1990s, the Israelis did not concede the land stolen in 1948, nor much of that in 1967, including Jerusalem, and Israel insisted that it continued to control the airspace. Although this news leaked on Thursday from documents obtained from the Camp David summit in the year 2000 is a rousing talk that some sort of peace could have been achieved between Barak and the late President Yasser Arafat still reeks of Barak's so-called generous offer. There is nothing generous about stealing land and lives, creating hundreds of thousands of refugees, and then offering peanuts. Barak's plan was passed on to Ariel Sharon, the military leader of Israel, who orchestrated the massacres in Lebanon's Sabra and Shatila refugee camps, and by whose orders thousands of Palestinians were imprisoned and killed. One must not be swayed by these recently leaked documents. Peace is not something that can be achieved without justice. There have been negotiations, but they do not follow through on them. The refugees were forced out and still have no rights. Jerusalem is our original land, and yet the people of Palestine are still willing to accept only East Jerusalem, but there's a border. It's called 1967. Earlier this week, Israeli bulldozers from the Israeli-controlled Jerusalem municipality demolished a home in the Palestinian Old City of East Jerusalem. This reeks of the years-long situation in the southern Gaza Strip's Rafah, where in the northern strip, resistance fighters are still attempting to strike back. But I was asked by the director of an Italian news agency, if Hamas had the weapons of Iran, why would they be firing these homemade projectiles that do no damage, that do nothing? During the destruction of the East Jerusalem home, Israeli forces attacked two brothers from the Kabeja family. One 20 years old, the other just 13, who attempted to remove their family's personal belongings and furniture before the destruction. They moved to the boundary. They built the wall. The refugees can't return, and Jerusalem isn't with us. We can't go to Jerusalem to pray, let alone most of us live there. Every Friday, because Jerusalem isn't accessible to us, you've seen the people. They're praying on the road, in the street. Where do they want to pray? In Al-Aqsa Mosque. Al-Aqsa is Jewish? Israeli settlers and soldiers now walk freely through the streets of East Jerusalem and its old city, while the soldiers revoke Palestinian IDs as they wish and overtake Al-Aqsa Mosque through continuing excavation projects while an Israeli flag is flown over the Palestinian section of the old city with a camera near it, plugging directly into the Israeli military security. The head of the leftist party, speaking from the small village, tells me that the Palestinian people have few options if they do not do the bidding of the Israelis and the Americans. We want democracy. Wasn't it democratic that Hamas was elected? But America didn't want it. Everyone was with Hamas. They were against America. But America doesn't want it. Reporting for Flashpoints from Occupied Palestine, I'm Kristen S.
Rock and roll music is the main weapon.
We now bring you Activist Nation, a segment focusing on direct actions across the country, bringing the voices of those organizing in the streets to the airwaves.
This is Joe Tugas with Activist Nation on Flashpoints, a new segment that illuminates various direct actions taking place across the country. Next year, Americans will vote for a presidential candidate like Republican Mike Huckabee, whose first act as governor of Arkansas was to block Medicaid from funding an abortion for a mentally retarded teenager who had been raped by her stepfather. Or Americans will vote for a Democratic candidate like Hillary Clinton, who now enshrouds abortion with the language of shame, calling it a tragic choice. A year ago, South Dakota nearly criminalized all abortion. A few months ago, Ohio proposed a requirement for women to get permission of the man involved before seeking an abortion, or else turn in a list to the state of all their sexual partners. Legal prosecution is underway against a doctor for performing late-term abortions a few months after the Supreme Court upheld the so-called partial birth abortion ban. A young man in Texas is in jail for life for assisting his girlfriend in self-inducing an abortion after a judge lied to her about her reproductive options. Christian pharmacists across the country are refusing to prescribe birth control to women. In Colorado, a ballot initiative is underway to designate a fertilized egg as a human being, potentially redefining abortion as murder, and anti-abortionists are launching similar initiatives in Georgia, Michigan, Mississippi, and Oregon. People on both sides of the debate are forecasting the most vicious and contentious political fight over abortion that America has ever seen. In the midst of all these attacks on women's reproductive rights and physical sovereignty, the 4th annual Anti-Abortion March will be taking place in San Francisco January 19th, an event that has featured about 10,000 anti-abortionists from around the country. In response to the so-called Walk for Life, the Bay Area Coalition on Reproductive Rights will be staging a counter-demonstration. On today's broadcast of Activist Nation on Flashpoints, I'll be speaking with a BayCorp activist on the local feminist response to the Walk for Life and the importance of standing up as a community for women's rights. Nancy Cotto is an activist with the Bay Area Coalition on Reproductive Rights and organizer for Radical Women. Nancy, welcome to Activist Nation here on Flashpoints.
Great, thank you for having me.
So this anti-abortion protest is taking place on January 19th. What is the Walk for Life and who is organizing it?
Well, the Walk for Life is being sponsored by the Catholic Church and appears to be just a diverse group of different anti-abortion faith-based folks. What they've done for, this is going to be the fourth year that they've been coming to San Francisco, is basically what they do is they basically gather thousands of people, they bust them in from all across the state, if not perhaps further away, and they are allowed to walk through the streets of San Francisco with their anti-abortion message. So they come to San Francisco, I think, because they think that as a very liberal city, as a city which has a lot of radical and progressive history, that they want to make their statement and bring their, frankly, message of hate to this town to say, you know, that they don't like abortions, they don't believe in abortions, and so what we do, have been doing every year for the past 3 years and going on the fourth year now, is BayCorp has been organizing large numbers of people as well to basically come out in support of not only abortion rights, but the right for a woman to be able to choose and for reproductive justice overall.
What groups or individuals make up the coalition for BayCorp?
Well, there's lots of there's a few organizations and many individuals, and we have a lot of sort of just a general activist support network, people finding out about the action and wanting to come out. So my organization, Radical Woman, is one of the co-founders of BayCorp. We have Gabriella Network. We have Code Pink. We have a bunch of different endorsers. Last year, we had the San Francisco Labor Council on board. We're going after another endorsement from them again this year. We've had local politicians. Ross Mirkett Tommy has endorsed and come out and spoken. Tom Almiano, the mayor came out 1 year, the first year that we had this. So there's a lot of interest, I think, and a lot of people are concerned about, you know, the anti-abortionism bringing their message of hate to San Francisco. So what we're really trying to do is to get the word out, because I think as soon as people find out that there's, you know, anti-abortion presence, organized presence in San Francisco, that they want to come out and show our side, and that people do believe that a woman has a right to choose what to do with her body. So we're really pushing to get folks out to help us out by, you know, passing out flyers, sending out emails to folks, just talking up amongst, you know, all their different communities and all their different friends, family, coworkers, and whatnot. Because, again, the more people know about it, the more people will come out.
What specifically is BayCorp going to do for the counter-demonstration?
Well, this year we've gotten Justin Herman Plaza down in the Embarcadero in San Francisco, and we'll be probably having speakers and a rally and music. But then what we also have done is line the march route. The Walk for Life has gone from the Embarcadero through past Pier 39 through Fisherman's Wharf, and eventually they end up at Christie Field. So we've been pretty much following them and also trying to line the march route and letting people know that, you know, we're not going to let the march unopposed, and that there is a pro-choice visible response.
In the past, some women's groups have avoided the counter-protest, claiming it only gives more media attention to the anti-abortion cause. Why do you think it's important to confront the anti-abortion movement in the streets?
They're trying to recruit, and they're trying to make their statement. We also want people to know that, no, it is important to confront them in the streets because that's where they're at. As you said in your introduction, there's a tremendous backlash against women's rights and a woman's right to be able to control her body. And now is the time, more so than ever, I believe, that we have to be out there to let people know. The Roe decision was won not by the Supreme Court granting women the right to be able to have an abortion, but because there was a movement, and movements are what make change, not just, you know, giving all our hope to our elected officials. And as we've seen, they've really, even the ones who were supposedly pro-abortion, have certainly backed off considerably. So really, we're saying we need to take matters into our own hands and make our stand now, because if we don't, we're going to lose not just the right to abortion, which pretty much is, you know, we don't have that accessibility anymore, but, you know, all our other rights as well. I mean, civil liberties are under attack, you know, queer rights are under attack, workers' rights are under attack, immigrants are under attack. So core, what distinguishes us from the other mainstream women's groups is that we believe that all these things are connected, and that is connected to a system which is built on oppression and repression. So we don't just focus on the right to abortion, but we're saying we have to have everything if we're really going to have choice for everybody.
So where can listeners go to get more information on how they can contribute to BACOR's counter-demonstration?
Well, our email address is bacorrinfo@gmail.com. Mm-hmm. And our phone number is 415-864-1278. And our website is www.bacorr.org.
Nancy Cotto, activist with BACOR, organizer for Radical Women, thanks for joining us for today's broadcast of Activist Nation on Flashpoints.
Great, thank you very much.
You are listening to another edition of the Black Report with the Minister of Information, J.R. December 13th is the second anniversary of the government assassination of Stanley Tookie Williams, who was killed by way of quote-unquote legal injection at San Quentin Prison. Stan was one of the founders of the Crip Gang, who later denounced gang life, authored 9 children's books, and was nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize a number of times. 2 years ago, the governor of California, Arnold Schwarzenegger, issued a justification letter to the public that stated why he was going to allow San Quentin Prison to kill Stanley Tookie Williams. On page 5 of this letter, the governor named Mumia Abu-Jamal, who is currently a political prisoner, as well as former political prisoner George Jackson, who was assassinated by San Quentin prison guards on August 21st, 1971, as reasons as to why Stanley Tookie Williams was not redeemed, quote unquote. Today we're going to be talking to Bonnie Williams, the former wife of Stanley Tookie Williams, as well as the mother of their biological son, Trayvon Williams, right here on the Black Report with the Minister of Information, J.R. Ms. Bonnie Williams, today is the second anniversary, as you very well know, of the assassination of Stanley Tookie Williams, your former husband, and also the father of your biological son, Trayvon Williams. What are your feelings on today?
Well, JR, as it would always be, and I'm sure as a lot of you feel out there in the Bay Area, you know, we're saddened. It's a never-ending journey that we are, you know, struggling to overcome, but we just have to keep on keeping on. We
yes, ma'am.
Keep on trying to do and continue his legacy and keep pushing what he was about.
What is Tookie Williams' legacy?
To me, Tookie Williams' legacy is about redemption. Redemption, showing that anyone can redeem themselves, okay? And also about peace.
Can you give a brief history of who is Tookie Williams to Los Angeles as well as the world?
Stanley Tookie Williams to Los Angeles is known as the co-founder of the Crips, which is true. But to the world, Stanley Tookie Williams is known as a six-time Nobel Peace Prize nominee and a soldier for peace, and one who redeemed himself from the pits of hell while being incarcerated in San Quentin.
How do you feel about the Stanley Tookie Williams movement today?
You know, JR, I must say I'm truly honored to have once been the wife of Stanley Tookie Williams, and more so to be the mother of his son and grandchildren. It's truly an honor. I have no regrets of ever knowing Stanley. It's a beautiful thing to hear from people like you and other people wherever we go, the love that's shown for Stanley. You know, it's all beautiful, but you know, we all truly dearly miss him, but his legacy is ongoing. It will live forever. He will live forever in the hearts of many.
What has the impact of the state assassination of Tookie Williams had on the streets? How have people that are from gangs in the Los Angeles area and all over the nation and the world, how have they responded to you in the last 2 years? And can you, you know, share some of the memories that you have?
You know, the response has been overwhelming right to this day. Prior to the anniversaries, the family's response from people, it's really, like, again, overwhelming. People are now, I see some of our old friends, some other triple OGs, they're now turning their lives around, although a lot of them were already straight, but they're about this movement. Everyone here in L.A. right now, what we have going on down here is everyone is trying to pull these kids off the street, bottom line. Everyone is working in different areas and have different organizations jumping off all around L.A. to save these children. And all of it started 2 years ago, and this is what Stan was about. So right now what we're doing down here in L.A., personally, us, the family, his son, Trayvon, we're pushing his peace protocol. That's our mission right now. We're going to push and implement that peace protocol worldwide.
Can you give the people a brief description of the peace protocol? What does the protocol talk about?
The peace protocol, personally to me, was Tookie's roadmap to freedom for our children, for the streets. It's like a map that he left for anyone who wants to renounce themselves from gang violence to do so. That he leaves, it's a step-by-step program that you can follow. And in order to renounce yourself from gangs, those of you who are affiliated with the gangs and don't know how to get out, those of you in the communities who are fearful of the gangs, he left or showed us a way to where we in the communities can come together, how to come together and combat these streets and gang violence. So basically it's like a roadmap that was left by Stan to clean up our communities. And everyone cannot interpret it. If you don't know the man, it would be hard. If you didn't know him, it would probably be kind of difficult. And this is what the word was here in L.A., that it was kind of difficult to understand. So this is where Trayvon is going to come in and go around and implement it, because he knew his father. And he knows exactly what he was saying. Of course, Dan had to talk in parables, coming from the walls of San Quentin, so he spoke in parables, so you have to kind of be able to break it down to layman's terms to get it right. We have contact information down here in L.A. We have the One Way Outreach Incorporation, which is a non-traditional youth basketball program and mentoring program for at-risk youth and their families. Our website is onewayoutreach.com. Our phone number here is area code 323-755-4702. Our P.O. box is P.O. box 90859, Los Angeles 90009. Again, that's One Way Outreach Incorporation. It's P.O. Box 90859, Los Angeles 90009. Anyone that wants some us to come out and implement this program in their communities, in their schools, we'll be more than happy to do so. And we're looking for any support or anything that anyone has to bring to the table for us because, you know, we are grassroots.
For those that are just tuning in, we are talking to Bonnie Williams, former wife of Stanley Tookie Williams, right here on the second anniversary since the United States government, by way of San Quentin Prison, assassinated Stanley Tookie Williams. What is the importance of the streets having access to Triple OGs who left the life, like Stanley Tookie Williams?
Having access to Triple OGs can give them a sense of, I want to say, being. Because they can let them know that that's not the way. Like the parents, uncles, aunts, everyone is trying to tell them. But sometimes hearing it from another seems to, for some strange reason, hit them, you know, they'll listen, basically. Especially those who was affiliated and friends of Stan, they know the truth. And to all the youngsters out there who have the respect and love for Stan as they do here, listen to them. Listen to your parents. You know, because you guys are our next generation, and we're losing you. We're losing you at a rapid rate. It's nonsense. You have to listen to someone. I regret I didn't listen. I'm sure Stan regretted he didn't listen. You know, but you have to listen to someone. I don't care if it is that Triple OG. You know right from wrong. Long as he's speaking the real and speaking the truth, hear him out. He know what he's talking about. He or she knows what she's talking about. They've been there. And it's just so, it's a lot more difficult and dangerous nowadays. And it's all a trap. It's designed for us as black and brown people to fail. It's designed for that. Look at Stan. It was a moratorium on the death penalty when Stan was arrested in 1979. They lifted that moratorium. Okay? They lifted it, meaning children, they said, okay, we're going to start killing again. Now, we have Stanley Tookie Williams. We're going to start killing again. They killed Stan December 13, 2005. Now, they're not killing anymore. Is that so hard for y'all to figure out? And it's designed to wipe our kids out. They're going to destroy our babies. You know, I can't cry out loud enough, JR, to try and save these children, you know?
Yes, ma'am.
And this is what this man was about, and I'd be less than a woman not to carry it out.
There's hundreds of organizations across the country, if not thousands, that say they working with youngsters involved in gangs and in the streets and that have, like, drug felonies and that are involved like that. But why are they not having impact? What is the importance, again, of like Triple OGs versus, you know, people who don't understand what these youngsters are going through? You know, what is the importance of that reality right there? And why are so many of these nonprofits that don't have that element involved not being successful?
One way outreach is going to show you, but I'm going to tell you a little bit. First of all, number one, you have to have a passion. You can't be in it for the money. You have to have a passion for these children. You know, I work with juveniles. You have to have a passion for these children, and you have to have a passion for what's going on in the world. So if you don't have that passion, it's basically like good cop, bad cop. You know, you have a lot of organizations out there doing it just to be doing it. They're doing it for the fame. They're doing it for that 15 minutes of fame. They're doing it for the money. Unless you have that passion for these kids, it's not going to work. And there's a few, there's a lot, I would say, that really have the passion. But basically, that's one of our major concerns is why, if everyone is doing this, why isn't it working? Where are we failing at? You know, so that's when Trayvon came up with his vision. So right now, like I said, we're at the grassroots, and so far it's working. We have 30 youth right now. And our kickoff date was October 30th, you know, so we have 30 youth right now. And I look at it that every Saturday, hey, this is 30 lives we're saving right now. For these 4 hours, we have these kids. But back to your question, I can't even say just what is really missing. I have my opinion. We just don't have enough to offer. We can't keep just having meetings.
Right.
You know, what I see is a lot of the organizations, they just meet. You can't just meet. You have to find something for these children to do. You know, that's why my son's, Trayvon's vision was basketball. And we pushing that through basketball. They get vocabulary words. They have homework assignments. They have to bring their report cards in. So it's like a triple threat, you know, that he saw. And if anyone go to that website, you'll see exactly what the organization is about. Basically, you have to have some resources for these kids and their families. You can't fix the child and then send him back home to a dysfunctional family. You understand what I'm saying?
Right.
You can take this kid and sit and talk to him till you blue in the face. But when you send him home and mama's sitting up in the back room with a pipe in her mouth and daddy's sitting up, had got the sister running, getting beers all day, it's not going to fix it.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to capture the family. And I think that's where a lot of our organizations are failing. We have to reach into that household and heal the whole household.
You was just listening to the voice of Bonnie Williams, former wife of Stanley Tookie Williams and mother of their biological son, Trayvon Williams, on the second anniversary of the U.S. government via San Quentin prison, killing Stanley Tookie Williams, murdering him, assassinating him on this day in 2005, right here on the Block Report with the Minister of Information, J.R. Can you give the website one more time, Ms. Bonnie Williams, where people can tune in to the real legacy of Stanley Tookie Williams and for those that want to help carry on his work?
Yes, the website is www.onewayoutreach.com. Our address is P.O. Box 90859, Los Angeles 9009. Again, that's onewayoutreach.com. That's one way, all one word, outreach.com. And I'm going to give Trayvon's email out there for those of you who want to give him a shout out or holler at him. His website is TWilliams1WayOut@yahoo.com. You can hit him up if you want him to come to your town, come to your community, and lay that peace protocol down, because that's what we're doing, and this is what his dad put it out there for. So we picking up on that, and we running with it. And I would like to give a shout-out to all the brothers up in San Quentin. I would like to give a shout-out to everybody up north for their love and their support on behalf of Stan's family. I continuously feel nothing but love from y'all up there, and we would just like to thank you, and let's just keep pushing what Tookie was about and try and save our babies.
Thank you again, Ms. Bonnie Williams, for being on the program.
Thanks for having me, JR.
You were just listening to the voice of Bonnie Williams, the former wife of Stanley Tookie Williams, on the second anniversary of the government assassination of Stanley Tookie Williams at San Quentin Prison. On the Block Report with the Minister of Information, JR. Now we're going to shift our attention to the Bayview newspaper Prisoner Subscription Fundraiser, which will take place Friday, December 14th, 2007 at 7 p.m. at Station 40, which is located at 3030 B 16th Street near BART at 16th and Mission in San Francisco. At the event, I will be showing slides about my recent trip to Brazil. Claude Marks will be showing a movie about women prisoners. Richard Brown of the San Francisco 8 will be talking about the importance of the Bayview newspaper to prisoners all across America. As well as Willie Radcliffe will be talking about the founding of the San Francisco Bayview newspaper. I hope that everyone can attend and check us out. Willie Radcliffe, can you tell us, how did you come to own the San Francisco Bayview newspaper and when?
It was in 1991. Actually, we were involved up in Alaska with a young lady that had a African-American newspaper in Anchorage, Alaska. And, of course, my activism has always been behind economics, people having jobs and opportunities. That way, they don't go to prison. And anyway, we've seen an opportunity to pull people together to help the business interests so we could hire people. And if you check out the amount of people in prison, you'll see how many of them didn't have a job, had no way of making a living. So they turned to crime. And so we wanted to do what we could do at the same time to make sure that there were jobs created for people rather than what they're doing now, is going in communities and pushing people out, putting them in jail. And now we have such a heavy burden of what we have to pay our taxpayers with our prison system. Now we are the worst in the world. We're supposed to have the best democracy in the world, but we also incarcerate more people, way more than anywhere in the world. So that was my idea of getting into journalism, something I'd never been into. But we wanted to get the word out to organize people to change our plight in this country, and especially in the community that we live in.
And what would you tell the listeners who have never seen the San Francisco Bayview newspaper? What is the purpose of the Bayview newspaper? And what year did you acquire it?
Well, we acquired the newspaper in 1991. We did our first issue in February of 1992. The reason we went into it is because I'm a businessman, and I've been suffering. Everybody around me is suffering. People of color is suffering. Our children are suffering. And I've seen it as an opportunity for people to put them all on the same page and know what's going on and organize to change that, you know, politically. Certainly there's a lot of political work to do to be able to have an economic change where people could have a living wage and be able to take care of their children and send them to college and have vacations. And that's what I was attempting to do and still is.
So when they look through the Bayview, what would a person see?
Well, a person will see what's going on, how the main news media do not talk about our problems. All they can talk about is negative things. They won't talk about what's really happening. You might notice the article in about the study of whitewashing the U.S. report on race cover reality of discrimination in America. So, you know, that was, we needed to get a paper out there that was talking about it. And that's what our paper's been about ever since it's been out there. And, of course, they've tried to shut us down and everything else, you know, because we do talk about issues other papers refuse to get involved in because of fear and retaliation as far as economics. Some people won't advertise. You know, figure they don't get no advertising. You know, and in a way, that's been the case. But right now, since so many people are reading our paper, our advertising is picking up while others are static.
For those that are just tuning in, you was just listening to the voice of Willie Radcliffe, the publisher of the San Francisco Bayview newspaper. Chris Blizzard, I want to bring Chris in, but before that, Willie, can you tell us how did the paper get involved with prisoners and how important is prisoners to the San Francisco Bayview newspaper?
Well, prisons are very important, you know. We need to change the prison industrial complex here, and you might notice the percentage of African Americans that look just like me is in prison. And the prison industrial complex has just gone wild. We have prisoners being able to write in our paper behind enemy lines. And, you know, we feel for prisoners. We feel for people that get caught up in that. So we want to give them an opportunity. And also when they come out, that they can get involved in changing systems. The prisoners come out now, they can't get no job, and then they just, you know, it's a revolving door. They go right back in for nothing.
We're going to bring Chris Blizzard in. Chris, I know that you're a volunteer. You occasionally write for the San Francisco Bayview newspaper, and you're helping to organize this fundraiser for the subscription prisoner fund that we have at the San Francisco Bayview newspaper. Tell the people what this fundraiser is about.
Originally, this idea got started at New College when I was going there, when my professor suggested to do a fundraiser for the paper to help raise money, and it gained momentum from there. And every week, I go through the mail and get letters every week from prisoners who want to get the paper. But, of course, that takes money, and that's why we're trying to do this event, to raise money, to send it out to more prisoners.
Now, when you open the mail and you read some of the mail, you know, what kind of things are prisoners talking about in regards to the San Francisco Bayview newspaper?
A lot of them talk about their situation. If I can, I'd like to read a short excerpt from one letter.
Okay.
This is from Mule Creek State Prison. It says, "I'm writing in hopes that I may somehow be added to your list of prisoners who may be eligible for a free subscription to the Bayview. Your publishing is a godsend to all the incarcerated Africans who must endure this American nightmare, better known as prison. I'm currently in ADSEG, or the hole, and your publishing is the only quality reading material I have come across. The norm as far as reading goes in prison is King or other urban magazines, which only further the current trend of devaluing and exploiting our culture and Sisters for the World to See. I, for one, am tired of this trend. Your publication would be a blessing, and I would share this gift with other Africans in my environment. So we get a lot of letters like that.
How much prisoner mail would you say the San Francisco Bayview newspaper receives on a weekly basis?
Anywhere from 50 to 100 letters.
And where do those letters come from?
A lot of them come from California, but they do also come across nationwide. But the majority are from California.
And can you name some of the facilities, some of the concentration camps that they come from?
Sure. Coalinga, California, Pleasant Valley State Prison. Corcoran, California, is also a California state prison. Of course, Pelican Bay State Prison, it's known to be one of the worst. Mule Creek State Prison. Folsom State Prison, San Quentin State Prison. Those are some common examples.
Tell us about this event that you're helping to put together.
The event, a lot of people are going to be coming to this event.
When is the event?
The event is going to be Friday, tomorrow night at 7 p.m., Station 40. Address is 3030 B Street, 16th and Mission, right next to the BART station.
In San Francisco?
Yes.
And what's going to be happening?
We're going to have Mr. Ratcliffe will be speaking. I think Richard Brown, the SF8, is going to be there. Jared Ball, who's a hip-hop candidate for the Green Party for president. Aaron Schumann, who's an activist and writer on prison issues. All of Us or None, actively involved with prisons. Critical Resistance, and of course, your slideshow, JR, about Brazil.
Chris, can you give the people one more excerpt of a prison letter, that one of the prison letters that the San Francisco Bayview newspaper has received?
Yes. This gentleman used to live and was raised in the Fillmore and also Visitation Valley, but now is in Oregon. He says, incarcerated, now free always, I receive uplifting news through your newspaper about once a month from a friend of mine who only deals with positive influences. What he didn't know is that my heart flutters when I get the Bayview news. And what does a brother have to do to receive your newspaper on a regular basis? I make a little money working in the garment factory, but I'm self-sufficient and receive little money from the outside. Besides, in the Oregon Department of Corruption, every single thing costs, all the way down to a washcloth. Whatever it takes, please help me in securing a chance to receive your amazing newspaper. There are some of us who remain strong and positive regardless of our situation. Your newspaper is a positive influence to keep me going in that direction.
You was just listening to the voice of Chris Blizzard, a volunteer with the San Francisco Bayview newspaper, an occasional writer who is helping to organize a fundraiser taking place tomorrow. What's the address, Chris?
3030 B Street, San Francisco.
At 7 p.m., fundraiser for the Prisoner Subscription Fund of the San Francisco Bayview newspaper. Mr. Ratcliffe, do you have any last words, and can you give some contact information for the newspaper?
We are here in San Francisco. Our address is 4917 3rd Street. Email address is sfbayview@sfbayview.com.
Editor at
sfbayview.com. And I would just like to wind up saying here that the Bayview has not only been there for prisoners, we've been there for people that's been harassed by the police. We've been there for the San Francisco 8. We've been there for Jamal. And we've been there for the people, and now we're asking the people to come on, let's get together and change our situation and keep the Bayview alive.
You were just listening to the voice of Willie Ratcliffe, the publisher of the San Francisco Bayview newspaper, and Chris Blizzard, who is a volunteer and occasional writer with the San Francisco Bayview newspaper. This is the Minister of Information, JR, for PLCC Black Report Radio on Flashpoints.
Commentary by Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Teaching false history and its consequences. Ask any school kid in the U.S. about the first English settlement in what we now call America, and he or she will proudly announce Jamestown. Some will add Virginia, and the truly nerdy would answer in 1607. Such children of the No Child Left Behind generation will beam in their brilliance, for no doubt they would recall that such answers earn passing grades on their many tests. And we know that tests are right, right? Wrong. The first English settlement was established over a generation before Jamestown in a place called Roanoke Island in 1584 and 1587 off the coast of what is today called North Carolina. Why are school kids taught about Jamestown but not about Roanoke Island? Because Jamestown survived and Roanoke vanished. 100 novels and a half dozen movies have been made of Roanoke Island, but the people were lost to witchcraft, to native spirits, or, in the best telling, they went native and joined local tribes. The real reason is a bit more grisly. Historian and lecturer William Loren Katz, in his remarkable book, Black Indians, A Hidden Heritage, first published in 1986, tells us that an eerily American ailment afflicted them. Katz writes, "What these pioneers did was self-destruct over their own love of possession. When a silver cup allegedly disappeared, the Roanoke men roared out of their tiny enclave, muskets and torches in hand, to destroy their Indian neighbor's village and crops. This blazing display of European possession mania cut the colony off from the one local source of help. When the Spanish Armada severed the settlement's connection to British ports, it withered and died. Roanoke Island became famous as the Lost Colony." In essence, telling kids the truth about Roanoke might destroy their sense of nascent nationalism and perhaps scare them. Instead, it's Jamestown, or perhaps Plymouth Rock, you know, the site of that glorious theocracy of 1620. If Roanoke's story were better known, perhaps lessons would be learned that stealing from others and raiding others isn't a good thing. Perhaps it would be an historical lesson about the perils of greed, or, in Katz's words, possession mania. Perhaps if kids were taught this version of history, the mad dash of imperialism that marked much of the 20th century would not have occurred. Maybe. From Death Row, this is Mumia. Abu Jamal. These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
And for listeners in the San Francisco Bay Area, Saturday, December 15th, All of Us or None is hosting a bike giveaway for the children of incarcerated parents. This is located at the Love Temple Baptist Church at 841 Birch Street in Oakland. 1 to 4 p.m. This is a free bike giveaway organized by formerly incarcerated people giving back to the community, and it's for children who have incarcerated parents. For more information, contact 510-410-1099.
That wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows-Friedman. Our contributing producer is Robert Knight. Our technical director is Eric Klein. And our production assistants are Emily Howard and Evelina Molina. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera. Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. Our weekly Best of Flashpoints program producer is Amanda Bellerby. To comment on today's program, please contact us at flashpoints@kpfa.org. Look us up on the web at flashpoints.net for our archive shows. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening.
In the mid-1980s, plays about AIDS started to emerge in the United States. In part, these early plays and the plays that followed them were calls to action. They documented the devastation within a community and showed how little was being done. Blending advocacy and art, the plays also gave us individual characters whose lives touched us deeply. On Open Book tomorrow, we'll hear about three landmark American plays dealing with the AIDS crisis. Don Shuey discusses Paula Vogel's The Baltimore Waltz, and Robert Vorlicky explores Tony Kushner's Pulitzer Prize-winning play Angels in America. This is produced by What's the Word? Tomorrow, Open Book, which is Fridays at 3 p.m. You are tuned to 94.1 KPFA Berkeley, 89.3 KPFB Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, and